today as we come to the table.
She was dead. What he did was he cut her in 12 pieces and sent a piece to all the 12 tribes of Israel, to their leaders, to say, this is what Gibeah did. You want to let this happen in Israel? Is this what you approve of? Is this something that you're in on? Because if not, we need to take action and we need to stop it now. And he would have sent one even to the Benjamites. Gibeah was in Benjamin. So he would have sent them one as well. They would have gotten their package. You know, I don't know, you know, which part he sent to them, but the bottom line is, he sends these parts out, as grotesque as this is, to really give them shock treatment. And the sad thing is, when a people or a nation becomes so cold to God and God's righteousness, sometimes it takes shock treatment to wake them up.
Have you ever tried to wake up a deep sleeper? You try a gentle voice or nudge, and as you increase the volume, you find that the only thing that works is a shocking level of noise, or even shocking the person till they come to. In a spiritual sense, much of the world around us is in a deep slumber, and if needed, God will use shock to get people's attention. Well, thanks for taking the time to join us as we come to the table, the daily Bible study program of Mark Kirk, Senior Pastor of Calvary Knoxville. As Pastor Mark will challenge us in today's message, we need to be diligently spreading the gospel as Christ's return approaches. Start with the soft, gentle nudges. But if it means the difference between heaven or hell for the lost, we can't be afraid to get loud. Now, let's join Pastor Mark in the book of Judges, chapter 19, with today's edition of Come to the Table.
Chapter 19, it came to pass in those days when there was no king in Israel. Remember the judges, there were no kings at this time. God would raise up judges, that is, prophets and just leaders at the time, before the kings came along, that there was a certain Levite, priest, if you will, staying in the remote mountains of Ephraim. Again, probably somewhere up near the Shiloh area, because that's where the tabernacle was for the first over 300 years when they came into the land. And this dating period now is not necessarily chronological. This is right after Joshua has died. To give you kind of a chronological of where we are. He took for himself a concubine from Bethlehem in Judah. And again, you know, what's this guy doing taking a concubine? We won't go into all that tonight, but basically kind of a second wife, sometimes a third and fourth wife, depending on how many they took. God never approved that, but we see that the culture did it, so they did it in that day. The wife was pretty much the one that was to be responsible for the family and the representative for the family, if you will. And the concubine was oftentimes, quite honestly, could be a second wife that was loved. We see with you know, Jacob had multiple wives as he was tricked into it. And then again, kind of added more on there. And others, we see that, you know, David took other wives and he seemed to love them. So it wasn't just necessarily for sexual means. But oftentimes in this day, the concubine was simply for sexual pleasure. That's how the world did it. And so they'd have a wife, and the wife took care of the duties, and then they would have basically their legal mistress on the side, but not something God approved of. And it would appear this might be the case with him, because she was not exactly the most upstanding woman we're going to see here. The story doesn't go well for her at all, and doesn't speak well for him, but that's the setting. And that's the thing I like about the Bible. God doesn't hide anything. He doesn't pretend that, you know, that only giving the nice things. He tells the whole story. And so that's part of what we deal with, and part of what is being dealt with here. So there's the scene. But his concubine played the harlot against him. Again, no surprise there, if in many ways, because of how concubines were basically used in that day. And he went away from him, she went away rather, to her father's house at Bethlehem in Judah, and was there 4 whole months. So basically she runs back to dad. She's up there in the Ephraim region, again, like we said, probably somewhere near around Shiloh, where the tabernacle was. And now she takes off back to dad, plays the harlot and takes off, not facing what was going on, the consequences, whatever the situation might be. And he waits for 4 months and decides he's going to go after her. I don't know why he waited 4 months, but he waited 4 months. Then her husband arose and went after her to speak kindly to her and to bring her back, having a servant and a couple of donkeys with him. So she brought him into her father's house. And when the father of the young woman saw him, he was glad to meet him. So, hey, you know, this is my daughter. She's not doing exactly very well. And I'm sure the dad knew that. And so, you know, the dads of that day, you would want your daughter married. The daughters, they couldn't work, couldn't have a regular job. So they needed a husband. They needed somebody to take care of them. And so he would have been happy to see that this man loved her because, you know, dad's got her back now and it's good to have a husband and somebody that can watch over her. And so probably multiple reasons that he, nice, you know, good to meet him, but no doubt there were some practical reasons in this. And his father-in-law, the young woman's father, detained him and he stayed with him 3 days and they ate and drank and lodged there. So again, this culture still today is very, very social. So, you know, see the family, you don't just travel all the way down that distance and, you know, pop in and pop out and you got to go. No, you spend time together and, you know, even, you know, just meeting somebody, you know, you spend hours together at a meal. So he spends now days together getting to know his father-in-law and trying to, again, win his wife back, his concubine back. And they spend this time together, not unusual for that culture, as I said. It came to pass on the fourth day that they rose early in the morning. And he stood to depart. But the young woman's father said to his son-in-law, refresh your heart with a morsel of bread and afterwards go your way. Now, this again was something they would often do as well. Whenever it's time to go, they'd say, well, just stay a little bit longer. Stay a little bit longer. Do a little bit more. Again, even culturally today, they do that. You know, stay a little bit longer, a little bit more and this kind of thing. So they're trying to get him to stay longer. And probably dad wants the daughter to stay a little bit more. He's not going to see her. Who knows when again? We know it'll be never, but he didn't know that. And probably enjoying getting to know his son-in-law and all that goes with that. So stay another day. So they sat down and the two of them ate and drank together. And then the young man's father said to the man, look, please be content to stay all night and let your heart be merry. So you keep you through most of the day, you know, socializing and all that. Now the sun's going down, it's getting late, you might as well stay and et cetera. Don't go now, it's too late. So stay another day and just spend the night. I don't know if he was just trying to get him to trick him into do that or not, but he did. And so he stays there again, you know, that night. When the man stood to depart, his father-in-law urged him, so he lodged there again. Then he rose early in the morning on the fifth day to depart from the young woman, from the young woman's father, and said, please refresh your heart. So they delayed until afternoon, and both of them ate. So here it goes again, that whole scene starting over, you know. And when the man stood to depart, he and his concubine and his servant, his father-in-law, the young woman's father, said to him, look, the day is now drawing toward evening. You know, here we go again. Please spend the night. See, the day is coming to an end. Lodge here, that your heart may be merry. Tomorrow go your way early so that you may get home. However, the man was not willing to spend that night. It's like, this is long enough. It's time now to get rolling here. So he rose and departed and came opposite Jebus, that is Jerusalem. Of course, it was called Jebus then. The Jebusites dwelt in that area before Israel took it over. With him were the two saddled donkeys. His concubine was also with him. And they were near Jebus, and the day was far spent. And the servant said to his master, come, please let us turn aside into this city of the Jebusites and lodge in it. But his master said to him, look, we will not turn aside into a city of foreigners who are not of the children of Israel. We'll go on to Gibeah. You know, I don't want to stay here. I don't know these people. How are they going to treat us? Are they going to be nice to us, mean to us? Let's move on to the next town. And this wouldn't be an easy thing to do, especially drawing late in the day, because you're traveling on a donkey. You can't exactly speed to the next town, so you don't want to travel after dark. That's not really safe. But he decided, you know what? Let's go for it. We can make this happen. We have time before the sun goes down. I don't want to be here with these foreigners that aren't Jews. They may, who knows how they're going to treat us and what's going to happen. So let's move on. So he said to his servant, come, let us draw near to one of these places and spend the night in Gibeah or in Ramah. Now Ramah again was even farther than Gibeah, I believe. So we're going to see they get to Gibeah first and decide to stay there. And they passed by one other way and the sun went down on them near Gibeah, which belongs to Benjamin. And they turned aside there to go and lodge at Gibeah. And they went in, he sat down in the open square of the city, for no one would take them into his house to spend the night. Now again, understanding that culture, what you would do is when you traveled as a Jew to other Jewish towns, if you went to the town, you needed a place to stay, you would go to the town square. You would just go there. We might say today, I mean, I don't know, maybe like going to Market Square, you know, it's about the most of a town square we have here in Knoxville where people would gather. And everybody would see you and say, well, you're not from here. Where are you from? Well, we live up so-and-so. We're in a place. And they would invite you in to stay in their house. Now, you wouldn't stay necessarily in the same room with them. You think, well, that could be dangerous, so to speak. But the way they built the houses back then, you'd oftentimes have additional rooms built on that were separated or another area. And you would invite people in to stay with you. It was just the polite cultural thing to do. You didn't let your brother, you know, stay outside, et cetera. And they really viewed each other literally as brothers. You know, we think about the church today and we talk about being a brother or a sister in the Lord, and we are, but they're literally family. And this really hit me when I was in Israel last year. As you guys know, that 5 weeks over there, when I was in Israel and teaching those classes over there, I got a chance just to kind of live among the people. And that's the longest. I've been on tours before, and you're there for like 2 weeks at a pop or whatever. But I've never just lived in Israel for an extended amount of time. And I had a little bit over a month just to live among the people. And you go to the regular grocery stores and the coffee shop and just hang out with the people. And the thing that really struck me, even still today, and that, by the way, they were very kind to a foreigner. They were very, very nice to me. Everybody was. It wasn't, there was nobody over there that I remember that was rude. You know, what are you doing here? And you're not one of us. They were very kind. You felt very welcome in all their establishments, their places and all that. It was very kind. But the thing that really struck me was how they treat each other really like family. It's not just, I mean, even if they don't know each other, it's not just like, yes, we're all from the same country, Israel. There's a realization among the Jews that they literally all have the same dad. I mean, think about that for a moment. Every one of them realize our dad's the same. Abraham is all of our dad. Everybody in this restaurant, everybody walking the streets of Tiberias, everybody in Jerusalem, our dad is the same dad. So even though I don't know you, there's almost this kind of like everybody understands we're really family for real. And it was a really weird but awesome, exciting feeling as that began to sink into me, because it's almost this, there's this atmosphere of, it's not like in America where everybody's from different backgrounds and different countries, and it's a wonderful, I understand they call it the American experiment or whatever, and how God has blessed this nation and all that's happened. That's wonderful. Nothing against that. But can you imagine if every single American had the same dad? How would we view each other in this room right now if everybody in America had the same dad? That's really an awesome thought to think about. Now, we as believers go beyond that because we do have the same dad. It's our Father in heaven. So we as family, and I'll tell you, I the longer I walk with the Lord, the more I appreciate each of you guys. And this is not one of those nice, oh, pastor moments. I really mean it. I really appreciate the family of God. And I know that sometimes the family of God doesn't get along. I know sometimes we bump heads and you know, things happen and arguments come up, and even sometimes, sadly, we part ways from each other. But I'll tell you what, there's nothing like coming to a place where everyone in here is like-minded. We all have the same Father, and we all love the same Father. And whether or not we're real close to each other, we have a built-in love for each other. So even as Israel has this really neat cultural thing where they all have the same dad, which we can't even associate with in America on a just American level, we have the same thing. How God has done with the Jews, he's done with the church. We all have the same dad. And the longer we walk with him and the more we understand that, the more we realize that we're family. They had this understanding. They show up to the town square. This is our family. Their dad is our dad. You need a place to stay? Come to my house. So they invite them to their house. That's what's going to happen here. That's what you would go and do. But nobody asks them to their home. Why? We're going to find out. This was a very wicked town. They didn't know it was a wicked town, but it was. And they realized that they had wicked people in this town. And if you brought somebody in your house, all the wicked people were going to show up to that house. And guess what? Break the door down to get your guests and abuse them, as we'll see in a moment, in a sexual way. This was a very perverted town. Remember the whole setting about judges? Everyone did what was right in their own eyes. To them, this was right. There was nothing wrong in this. And so we're going to get to that in a moment, but that's the setting. And so they go there to the town square, so to speak. No one would take them in. And they realize, this is odd. We're brothers. Our dad's Abraham. Your dad's Abraham. Why is no one inviting us in their home? This would have been very, very rude culturally, uncharacteristic culturally, shocking culturally. If you just took people in. They didn't really have hotels. You had some places in some cities that were like a hotel, but really you didn't have them. And most everywhere you went, you stayed with people. Just then, verse 16, an old man came in from his work in the field at evening, who also was from the mountains of Ephraim, who was staying in Gibeah, whereas the men of the place were Benjamites. And when he raised his eyes, he saw the traveler in the open square of the city. And the old man said, "Where are you going and where do you come from?" He said, "We're passing from Bethlehem, Judah, toward the remote mountains of Ephraim. I'm from there. I went to Bethlehem in Judah, and now I'm going to the house of the Lord." So I'm going back to probably Shiloh. "But there is no one who will take me into his house." You know, it's interesting. We tend to think that if we're a Christian, everyone will like us and be nice to us. You ever made that mistake? I had this mindset when I first came to the Lord of, we're nice people. We are. I mean, yeah, we get mad, we get upset, but generally, we're pretty nice. And we love each other. We're nice to people that don't know the Lord. You know, sometimes we're not. We understand that. We're not always nice. But I found out that the world, just because you're nice, they will still hate you. But he's probably thinking, not only are we family, but I'm a pastor, for crying out loud. Now, he was a priest, but get the mindset. So not only is everybody rejecting me, it'd be like, hey, there's a pastor in town. Can anybody house him? Nope. There's no place for him to stay. tough cookies or whatever. You're not staying here. That's not a good saying, tough cookie. What's a tough cookie? I don't know. You're not staying at our place, right? So this is a pretty interesting scenario here, what's happening. This man who's coming to help him realizes, I know what's going on. You don't know. This is a wicked town. You can't stay in the town square. I'll take my chances. You stay in the town square, you're toast. And we're going to find out they try to make him toast even when he comes into this man's house. And by the way, when you came into someone's house, if you were invited in, they were bound to protect you. Even today in that culture, if you go to somebody's house in the Middle East like that, or even those tents in the wilderness, the Bedouins that travel around, they will fight for you. Even if you don't, you know, I've been told this, and I'm not experienced it. I've been told by those who know the land, they'll fight for you. If you're in their house and somebody comes to get you, they'll fight. They'll put their own life at risk if you're their guest in their home. Because it's a cultural thing. So when he asks them to come in, what he's saying is, you're coming into my protection as well. If somebody's coming after you, they're coming after me. So now you get the setting here even more so. He says, oh, nobody's come to get us, although we have both straw and fodder for our donkeys and bread and wine for myself, for your female servant, for the young man who's with your servant. There's no lack of anything. We don't need you to give us any food or buy our meals or provide for our animals. We've got everything we need. No one will let us sleep at their house. And the old man said, well, peace be with you. However, let all your needs be my responsibility. Look, I'm glad you've got everything, but no, forget it. I'm buying dinner tonight. You're coming to my place. Only don't spend the night in the open square. So he brought him into his house and gave fodder to the donkeys, and they washed their feet, and not the donkey's feet, the people's feet. And they ate and they drank. Just wanted to point that out because that did kind of read that way. Anyway, just kidding. You'll never read that the same. I apologize. I shouldn't do that to you. As they were enjoying themselves, suddenly certain men of the city, perverted men, surrounded the house and beat on the door. The Bible speaks of it very kindly here, but in other words, this is speaking of men that were homosexual. We'll get to that in a moment. It says, they spoke to the master of the house, the old man, saying, bring out the man who came to your house that we may know him carnally. It means that we may basically have sex with him. So a bunch of men surround the house. They say, bring out that pastor that's at your house. We want to rape him. And that's the setting. Now you see what kind of people were living here in Gibeah. By the way, not necessarily homosexual rape, but even in this culture today, among some of the Arab countries, they still have these mass rapes that take place. Maybe you've heard of it. Maybe you've seen that. It's the most horrific thing that can happen. I won't go into detail about it, but some of the men will just mass rape women if they have the opportunity. And again, you tend to think that's certainly not cultural, but I tend to think that has a lot to do with the spirit or the spirits, of that area. You know, it's interesting. The Bible says there are certain demons over certain regions of the earth, the fallen angels. We see in Daniel that there are certain fallen angels that have rulership over certain areas. And I've just lately been kind of really paying attention to, it seems like every generation throughout history there in the Syria area has been a really wicked generation. I'm not picking on the Syrian people. There's a lot of good people from Syria. This is not about a personal thing. But when you look back historically, because me being a pastor and having studied the peoples of that area back in the biblical days, even before Jesus and now up to now, it's always been an area where they cut off heads and cut out tongues and cut off ears and torture people. It's always been that. Throughout world history, that region has been known for that. As a matter of fact, Canaan and Syria region is why God brought the children of Israel in and judged them all and ran them out. And I tend to believe that it probably has a lot to do with the demonic presence, the demons that are over that region. Some regions are worse than others. And again, we see from Daniel, you can see that. I believe it's Daniel chapter 10. And in that area where it talks about the prince of Greece and all these different things, and they're spiritual beings it's talking about, because Michael the archangel had to fight through them, or Gabriel rather, had to fight through them to get to Daniel, when Daniel was praying and all that. So we see the spiritual battle going on. And so again here, I don't know, no doubt this is demonic. But when you see some of these same things going on over in that region today, this still happens to some degree over there. So that's why you see that same spirit that's going on. It says, but the man, the master of the house, went out to them and said to them, no, my brethren. Now, that's interesting. I beg you, do not act so wickedly. Seeing this man has come into my house, do not commit this outrage. Now, probably saying my brethren just to kind of get on their good side and maybe acknowledging that these are all the same children of Abraham, but these certainly were not brethren in the sense of the Lord. He says, don't commit this outrage. Now, this is something that's going to shock some of you, but look at this, verse 24. Look, here's my virgin daughter, the man's concubine, both of them. Let me bring them out now. Humble them and do them as you please, but do not do such a vile thing to this man. Jesus Christ in a culture changes things for women. Over the years, you hear things about Christianity is oppressive to women and et cetera, et cetera. Go to countries where Jesus Christ is not honored. Look at how the women are treated. Animals. They're treated like animals. And that's what's happening here. She was nothing more than something to be used and abused. Jesus Christ is the one who elevated the woman to the proper place of honor that is her rightful place. And that is with equality with the man, but in the proper authority structure of God. And when you look throughout history, you'll find out that it's Jesus that has raised women up. It's Jesus that has been the hero of women. And so it bothers me when I see women attack Christianity or talk about oppressiveness of the Lord or some of these women's movements where they make this stand against. They don't realize if they were not in a country where Jesus Christ was not honored, they wouldn't have the right to make a stand. And so God has been, he's very good. Wherever Jesus is invited, the culture is raised to a higher standard and a higher place. And now to see a dad that would offer his daughter. We talked about protecting someone that came into your home, but I think that's part of it. But I think also it has to do with the culture where women were just seen so much less than men. They were seen really as property. And so in many ways, not much more than handing one of their cattle over to someone. And so as sad as that is, that's the reality of what it's like in different cultures and what it was in this day in Israel. But the men would not heed him, so the man took his concubine and brought her out to them. Now, the man apparently intervened here and said, no, don't send your daughter out there. She's young. She's a virgin. This is an older woman. And again, he knew that she was not a virgin. There's no excuse for any of this. But he takes now this concubine and, you know, hands her over to these men. And they knew her. That means sexually. They basically raped her and abused her all night until morning. And when the day began to break, they let her go. And the woman came as the day was dawning and fell down at the door of the man's house where the master was till it was light. And when the master arose in the morning, he opened the doors of the house, went out to go his way. I mean, just he went to bed last night and was able to sleep. That's amazing to me. And there was his concubine fallen at the door of the house with her hands on the threshold. I mean, you would think that he would just collapse and help her up and what, you know, but look what happens. Verse 20, he said to her, get up and let's be going. Again, not much of a heart here for her. I guess her dad probably wished he hadn't come back to get her. But there was no answer. Basically, she was dead. So the man lifted her onto the donkey, and the man got up and went to his place. And when he entered his house, he took a knife, laid hold of his concubine, and divided her into 12 pieces, limb by limb, and sent her throughout the territory of Israel. Now, he's going to use shock treatment here. And as grotesque as this is, we're going to see that it was effective. And what does that mean? She was dead. What he did was he cut her in 12 pieces and sent a piece to all the 12 tribes of Israel, to their leaders, to say, this is what Gibeah did. You want to let this happen in Israel? Is this what you approve of? Is this something that you're in on? Because if not, we need to take action and we need to stop it now. And he would have sent one even to the Benjamites. Gibeah was in Benjamin. So he would have sent them one as well. They would have gotten their package. You know, I don't know, you know, which part he sent to them, but the bottom line is, he sends these parts out, as grotesque as this is, to really give them shock treatment. And the sad thing is when a people or a nation becomes so cold to God and God's righteousness, sometimes it takes shock treatment to wake them up. I don't like seeing pictures of aborted babies any more than you do. But I have to admit, I remember seeing one go by on the side of a truck, and it was the most horrific thing. And I kind of turned away thinking, you know what, that's horrific. And yet if that's what it takes to wake up a nation, it made me think of this story. The concubine that was cut in 12 pieces and sent around the nation. I'm not saying we should go out and put up posters of the terrors of abortion. But there is something to be said about shock treatment when a nation has gone so to sleep in their sin.
Thanks for joining us today on Come to the Table with Pastor Mark Kirk. Pastor Mark is teaching through the book of Judges, which documents a period of time when the young nation of Israel lacked consistent leadership. Two of the greatest leaders, Moses and Joshua, had passed away, and there was no king yet. The Canaanites still inhabited the land, and they repeatedly caused the Israelites to worship idols. God would then allow Israel to fall into the hands of neighboring peoples who would torment and mistreat the Israelites. Israel would finally repent and cry out to God, and each time, God was merciful and raised up leaders called judges to rescue his people. This happened over and over, but God never abandoned his people. Maybe you can relate to the Israelites. You've fallen away from God repeatedly, and you're not sure if he'll accept you anymore. The good news is, God is waiting for you to come back to him. He's always willing and able to forgive you of your sins. So, what are you waiting for? If you have any questions about what you've heard today, you can give us a call at 865-609-1385. We'd love to have a conversation with you. Once again, that's 865-609-1385. If you're in the Knoxville area, we'd love for you to come to Calvary Knoxville this Sunday. We want to meet you. Feel free to refer to our website for service times, thewaymedia.net. Scroll down the page and find a link to Calvary Knoxville. We're so glad you joined us today. Be sure to listen again next time, right here on Come to the Table. Come to the Table is a radio outreach ministry of Calvary Knoxville.